Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Atlantic Magazine program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. I'll be reading articles from the online edition of the Atlantic. All of them are dated January 2025. Here's a sampling of the ones I know we'll have time for. You'll never get off the dinner treadmill. Don't mention the coup. Coffee's grip on America. And yes, the law can still constrain Trump. Hopefully we'll have time for one or two additional articles. I hope you enjoy the program. I'll begin with this one. You'll never get off the dinner treadmill. There's no such thing as an easy weeknight meal. By Rachel Sugar. A quiet monologue runs through my head at all times. It is this: dinner, 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 dinner. The thing about dinner is that you have to deal with it every single night. Figuring out what to eat is a pleasure until it becomes a constant low-grade grind. It's not just the cooking that wears me down, but the meal planning and the grocery shopping and the soon-to-be-rotting produce sitting in my fridge. It is time it sucks up during the week. It is the endless mental energy. Huh, I think, at 6 p.m., dicing onions. So, we're still doing this? I can compromise on breakfast. It is absolutely normal to eat the same breakfast every single day for years, and equally normal to eat nothing. Lunch? Eat it. Skip it. Have some carrot sticks. Who cares? Lunch is a meal of convenience. But dinner is special. Dinner isn't just the largest meal of the standard American diet. It is the most important, the most nourishing, the most freighted with moral weight. The mythical dream of dinner is that after a hard but wholesome day at school or work, the family unit is reunited over a hot meal, freshly prepared. Even if you're dining solo, dinner tends to be eaten in a state of relative leisure, signaling a transition into the time of day when you are no longer beholden to your job. You could eat a full bag of Doritos. Margot Finn, a food studies scholar at the University of Michigan, told me, but that doesn't quite cut it for dinner. There's no paucity there. There's some lack. The dinner problem may be especially acute for working parents like me. Children are unrelenting in their demand to eat at regular intervals, but it spares almost no one. Disposable income helps mitigate the issue. Disposable income helps mitigate most issues. But short of a paid staff, money does not solve it. I could accept this as a price of being human if everywhere I looked there was not someone promising a way out. The sheer number of hacks and services and appliances and startups suggests that some kind of dinner resolution is forthcoming. How could it not be solvable with this many options? We are living in what might be the world historic peak of dinner solutions. A whole canon of cookbooks is devoted to quick and easy weeknight dinners for busy families, and entire freezer cases dedicated to microwavable meals. There is takeout and prepared food, and DoorDash, and a staggering number of prep guides outlining how to cook in bulk one day a week. And yet, none of it has managed to solve the problem. Dinner exists, daunting and ominous. As it stands, dinner is a game of trade-offs. You can labor over beautiful and wholesome meals, but it is so much work. You can heat up a Trader Joe's frozen burrito or grab McDonald's. There is a reason that as of 2016, the last time the government counted, 1/3 of American adults ate fast food on any given day. But you don't have to be a health fanatic to aspire to a more balanced diet. You could get takeout, but it's notoriously expensive and frequently soggy, more a novelty than a regular occurrence. Delivery apps, at least, offer the promise of extreme convenience, except that they are even more expensive, and the food is often even soggier. In spite of all these options, if you cannot free yourself from dinner, you're not alone. The many attempts to make dinner painless have not lived up to their promise. Remember Soylent? One of the bolder possibilities for a while was a shake that pledged to make things a lot less complicated by replacing conventional food with a deconstructed slurry of nutrients. I do want things to be less complicated, but I also want variety. I want to chew. A lot of other people seem to want these things too, which is presumably one reason food-based dinner persists, and Soylent has mellowed into a nutritional supplement lifestyle brand. Given the general enthusiasm for eating, most proposed innovations have focused on easing the labor of making dinner. Grocery stores offer pre-chopped produce. Whole Foods briefly experimented with an on-site produce butcher who would slice or dice or julienne your vegetables. Meal kits that ship portioned ingredients to your doorstep ought to be an obvious solution, and for a minute, it seemed like maybe they were. In 2015, Blue Apron was valued at $2 billion, and according to TechCrunch, was poised to reach 99% of potential home cooks. It did not, in fact, reach 99% of potential home cooks, nor did any of its competitors. There are still people who really love meal kits. Jeff Wells, the lead editor of Grocery Dive, a trade publication, told me. There just aren't that many of them relative to the overall food shopping population. The problem is the cost, or the menu, or the quality, or the lack of leftovers, or the prep time. When one dinner solution fizzles, there's always another, and another, which will be superseded by still more. Lately, Wells said, grocery stores have been investing in their prepared-to-go options, with in-store pizza counters and plastic clamshells of deli salads and ready-to-heat containers of spaghetti. Everywhere I look, I seem to be inundated with new and somehow improved solutions. On Instagram, I learned about a new delivery service that is in the process of expanding to my area. While streaming a movie, I was introduced repeatedly to a company that sells healthy meals I could have ready in 2 minutes. Every time I turn on a podcast, I am informed about a meal kit company that, if I use the promo code, will give me free dessert for life. They all promise the same thing. The dinner could be painless, if I let it. I could have it all, my dinner and my sanity. Of course, all of these options still require divesting from the Norman Rockwell dream of home-cooked dinner. The ideal of dinner has made me resentful and occasionally unpleasant, and at the same time, I viscerally do not want to eat a vat of pre-cooked spaghetti. I can make spaghetti, I thought. But then I was back where I began. Most of us have two basic choices. You can make the necessary compromises and accept something less than optimal, or you can surrender to a wholesome trap of your own making. You can buy the pre-chopped onions, or you can suck it up and chop your own onions. Those are the choices. The notion that there is a permanent way out, a hack, a kit, a service that gives you all the benefits of dinner cooked from scratch without the labor, is an illusion. You cannot have a meal that both is and is not homemade. Schrodinger's salmon over couscous with broccoli rabe. Dinner resists optimization. It can be creative and it can be pleasurable. None of this negates the fact that it is a grind. It will always be a grind. You will always have to think about it, unless you have someone else to think about it for you, and it will always require too much time, or too much energy, or too much money, or some combination of the three. It is unrelenting, in the way that breathing is unrelenting. There is a freedom in surrendering to this, that even in this golden age of technological progress, dinner refuses to be solved. And that completes the article. The author, Rachel Sugar, is a contributing writer at The Atlantic. And the title of her article was, You'll Never Get Off the Dinner Treadmill. The second article today is titled, Don't Mention the Coup. The memory of January 6th vanishes from Trump's new Washington, by David Frum. The President of the United States is the country's chief law enforcement officer and the symbol of national authority and unity. This incoming president faces a battery of criminal charges relating to his abuse of office and to personal frauds. He's been convicted of some already. More are pending. He is also the author of a conspiracy to overthrow the 2020 election and seize power by violence. More than 1,000 of his followers have been convicted and sentenced for their roles in his attempted coup d'etat. These two sets of facts are obviously in considerable tension. How will they be resolved? A strong desire exists, not only among pro-Donald Trump partisans, to wish away the contradiction. Trump will be president again. Every domestic interest group, every faction in Congress, every foreign government will need to do business with him. It's unavoidable. The system cannot operate around him as if he were not there. What cannot be avoided will not be avoided. And because most of us need to believe in what we are doing, almost every institution in American society and the great majority of its wealthiest and most influential citizens will find some way to make peace with Trump's actions on January 6, 2021. Nobody wants to say aloud, the Constitution is all very well up to a point, but the needs of the National Association of Birdhouse Manufacturers must come first. Inevitably, though, our words come into alignment with our interests, and our thoughts then come into alignment with our words. On the ever rarer occasions when the January 6th insurrection is discussed, the excuses will flow more and more readily. Trump didn't conspire. It was just a protest that got out of hand. Only a tiny majority broke any important laws. Surely they have already been punished enough. Anyway, the George Floyd protests were worse. Even Trump's opponents will fall more or less in line. As Democrats try to make sense of their 2024 defeat, some are already arguing that the party paid too much attention to procedural issues, too much talk about democracy, not enough about the price of eggs. Many will argue that the best way to win in 2028 is to attack Trump and his administration as servants of the ultra-rich. In other words, by dusting off the playbook that Democrats have traditionally run against Republicans. Hillary Clinton, Joe Biden, and Kamala Harris all campaigned against Trump as a kind of aberration. All welcome the support of non-Trump Republicans. Next time, things are likely to be different. Trump will be lumped together with all of his Republican predecessors, and the way to succeed in the lumping together is by jettisoning the topics on which Trump is unique, violent coup d'etat, and focusing on the topics where he is not unique, tax cuts for the rich and regulatory favors to corporations. The attempted coup of 2021 will be unhelpful old news in a 2028 cycle defined by performative populism. These imperatives will apply even to that supposed incubator of anti-Trump feeling, the sad dying remnants of what used to be called the mainstream media. Today, of course, anti-Semitics and anti-vax cranks on YouTube draw much bigger audiences than any program on CNN or MSNBC. So what counts as mainstream or fringe is a very open question. If you're a normal journalist trying to report on inauguration plans or the staffing of the cabinet or the administration's first budget, your job depends on access, and access depends on playing ball to a greater or lesser degree. If you keep banging on about an attempted coup that happened 4 years ago, you are just making yourself irrelevant. And when you encounter somebody else who bangs on about it, you will be tempted to dismiss them as irrelevant too. The coup makers won. The coup resistors lost. Washington is not a city that spares much sympathy for losers. This never happened, advises Don Draper on the television series Mad Men. It will shock you how much it never happened. So it will be with the first attempt by a serving president to overthrow the government he was sworn to protect. Not all of us, however, have to live in the world of Washington transactions. Some of us need to volunteer to keep talking about the inconvenient things. Trump really did try, by violence, to violate the first rule of constitutional democracy: respect elections. Constitutional democracy matters, whether or not the theme helps Democratic candidates for federal office, whether or not it energizes media consumers, whether or not it advances the lobbying agenda of the National Association of Birdhouse Manufacturers. Those volunteers don't need to blame those other Washington players for doing what they feel they need to do. The volunteers have only to remain faithful to their purpose, to push back against the Draper doctrine that the unwanted past can be made to disappear. It did happen. It should still shock us how much it did happen. That completes the article. The author, David Frum, is a staff writer at The Atlantic. The title of his article was "Don't Mention the Coup." The next article's title is "Coffee's Grip on America." Inflation hardly hampered Americans' love of buying the beverage, by Laura Kelly. American personal finance gurus love to rail against the habit of spending money on coffee. The finance personality Suze Osman once compared buying coffee outside the house to peeing $1 million down the drain. But this criticism hasn't curbed Americans' love of ordering coffee. Neither has a years-long stretch of brutal inflation. Through it all, Americans have kept purchasing their lattes and Americanos and drips, their cold foams and pumps of flavor and alternative milks. Most American adults drink coffee regularly. The beverage is inescapable in America, in part because it has enabled the long work hours that contribute to America's culture of productivity. As Michael Pollan wrote in The Atlantic in 2020, coffee has created exactly the kind of world that coffee needs to thrive. But this alone doesn't explain its pull. Many people view the act of buying a cup of coffee as a small pleasure, one that fits easily into a busy routine. as the price of everything, including lattes, has gone up in recent years, Americans have stood by this particular habit. Inflation-squeezed consumers are shying away from eating at restaurants, but many have kept indulging in to-go coffee. Starbucks is stumbling. Last year, its sales and store traffic dipped. Its workers went on strike, and it brought in yet another new CEO. But cafes are flourishing overall. The retail research firm, Circana, found that spending at coffee shops in 2024 was up 55% compared with 2017. Restaurant spending overall was up about 20% in that period. Businesses serving coffee and tea are one of the fastest-growing slices of the restaurant industry. Because coffee has a price cap that's fairly low, it is generally the last to go when people are cutting back on meals out. Alex Susskind, a professor of food and beverage management at Cornell, told me, "A restaurant dinner could cost hundreds of dollars, but even the most elaborate coffee concoction in most cities couldn't be more than $8. I am ignoring stunt orders, such as this one that apparently involved 101 shots of espresso. Spending more than a few dollars on a coffee drink might seem absurd, especially to those who grew up in an era of much lower pricing. But many people continue to view coffee as a relatively affordable luxury, making it unique in the realm of dining out," Susskind noted. "Just like fast food chains, which did well in the second half of last year, coffee survives through customers' strong perception that the price won't go above a certain threshold. But even the last to go may be a shaky future. In December, coffee hit its highest price in nearly 50 years. Major droughts in coffee-growing areas, such as Brazil, meant that the cost of Arabica beans, a common variety served in the United States, went up about 70% in 2024. The price has eased slightly in recent weeks, from $3.35 a pound to $3.20 a pound, but it was closer to $1.80 this time last year. Store brands such as Nescafe and Folgers have raised their prices, pointing to bean costs. In 2025, coffee shops will need to decide how much of the expense to pass on to coffee drinkers. With all of the resources and labor that go into it, a cup of coffee arguably should cost more than what we pay for it now. If coffee prices keep rising, coffee enthusiasts may be forced to consider how much their daily ritual is truly worth." And that completes the article, Coffee's Grip on America, by Laura Kelly. I'm going to take a brief moment to remind those of you that may have tuned in late, this is the Atlantic Magazine program, brought to you by SunSounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your SunSounds volunteer reader. I'm reading from the online edition of the Atlantic Magazine. The articles I'm reading were all published in January of 2025. This next title is, Yes, the Law Can Still Constrain Trump. It's not a magic wand to save America, but neither is it entirely useless, by Juanita Jurcik. Donald Trump wasted little time after the election in claiming an unprecedented and powerful mandate and floating a series of extreme proposals with varying degrees of legal dubiousness. The president-elect has already winkingly suggested that he might stay in office for an unconstitutional third term, indicated that he intends to end the Constitution's guarantee of birthright citizenship, and said that he plans to deport U.S. citizens. If the mood on the right is triumphant, the atmosphere among those opposed to Trump has been despairing, as though nothing can be done to hold him back from what he has planned. A representative headline in Slate read, "Is the law for suckers now?" It's tempting to conclude that the answer is yes. The country elected a man who has been indicted 4 times, essentially wiping away any chance that he might face criminal accountability for his effort to hold on to power after losing re-election in 2020. The Supreme Court, in issuing its shocking immunity ruling this summer, seems newly on board with the idea that the chief executive can more or less do whatever he likes. What do legal restrictions and constitutional processes matter in the face of a politics that has lost any semblance of reason? A great deal, in fact. The country has come a long way from the starry-eyed early days of the Russian investigation, when Trump's opponents purchased votive candles printed with special counsel Robert Mueller's face on them and dreamed of a criminal prosecution that might end Trump's presidency. Sure, the law is not a magic wand to save America, but neither is it entirely useless. Acknowledging the threat that Trump poses to American democracy does not require accepting that he is unbound by law. On the contrary, taking the risk seriously requires taking seriously the legal and political mechanisms available to prevent the worst of Trump's intended abuses. Those mechanisms are available partly because of Trump's own shortcomings. As would-be authoritarians go, Trump is often lazy, prone to whims, easily distracted, and poorly organized. And each of those shortcomings can create legal and political weaknesses for his administration. The New York Times columnist Jamelle Bouie argued shortly following Trump's re-election that there is a large gap between a stated intention and an accomplished fact, and it is within that space that politics happens. The country has already caught a glimpse of how this process can play out as Trump has begun to assemble his cabinet. Within weeks of the election, the vision of a victorious, crusading Trump that his allies promoted swiftly crumbled into something a lot more familiar, a chaotic, grinding slog. That may not sound particularly encouraging, but for those who care about democracy, it's actually welcome news. The first hint of breakdown emerged out of the constitutional dynamics between the executive and legislative branches. The Republican Party secured a less than overwhelming 4-seat majority in the Senate, meaning that the new administration can lose only a handful of votes for confirming Trump's cabinet nominees. Briefly, it seemed that Trump's team had dreamed up a solution in order to jam through the president-elect's more controversial nominees, force the Senate into a recess by inexcusably contorting the Constitution, then use the president's ability to fill cabinet slots unilaterally when the Senate is gone. The idea was disturbing. It recalled the monarchical power to dissolve Parliament, and in that sense spoke to an absolutist vision of presidential authority entirely unchecked by the legislature or any competing center of power. But the incoming administration appears to have backed away from the scheme after Ed Whalen, a fixture of the conservative legal movement, raised alarm about the scheme and voiced doubts about its constitutionality. One of Trump's most controversial and least supported nominees, former Representative Matt Gaetz, has since withdrawn from consideration rather than hope for a recess appointment. Even if Trump's team decides to pull the trigger on the plan at a future date, they will face no end of difficulty in practice. To begin with, the scheme would require the House to recess first, but the GOP's House majority is extremely tight, and there is no guarantee that Speaker Mike Johnson could secure the votes to send his chamber home in service of such a scheme, even if he wanted to. In the weeks since Whelan first warned against the idea, legal academics of all political stripes have begun assembling a range of compelling arguments as to why the plan would be unconstitutional, arguments that a Trump administration would have to face down in court. Even if such litigation makes it up to a potentially sympathetic Supreme Court, and even if the court is sympathetic, Trump would confront the problem that three of the conservative justices previously signed on to an opinion holding that a president may only fill vacancies during a recess that arose during the recess itself, significantly limiting this immense claim of power. None of this is to say that the House, the Senate, or a majority of the justices are pure and principled actors, or that respect for the text of the Constitution will be enough to stiffen their spines against Trump. But the combination of public outrage, the existence of strong legal arguments against Trump's actions, and the total lack of strong legal arguments for them is potentially significant. Each element makes going along with him a little more difficult for Congress and the court, especially because, even if many members of the public have given up on thinking of the court as anything more than a political body, some of the justices still want to be able to think of themselves as fair and impartial jurists. And the more difficulty that Trump encounters, the more likely that he shrugs his shoulders and moves on to the next whim. The same is true when it comes to the specific policies that Trump has promised to implement during his second term, many of them arguably or even blatantly illegal. Dora Lind of the American Immigration Council has pointed out that anxious rhetoric around Trump's promised mass deportations often eludes the challenging and perhaps insurmountable logistical realities of organizing and executing such an incredibly complex operation. Litigation is part of those logistical realities, too. Consider Trump's promise to end the 14th Amendment's guarantee of birthright citizenship, which will reportedly involve an executive order directing the federal government not to issue Social Security numbers to babies born on U.S. soil to parents who are neither citizens nor green card holders. How is the Social Security Administration meant to ascertain the citizenship of an infant's parents? What happens when that agency and others are hit with a wave of lawsuits from organizations challenging the order? A signature on an executive order is a very different thing than actually putting a policy into effect. It's difficult to gauge what the litigation might look like in advance, but the first Trump administration offers instructive examples. Consider the case of the travel ban during the first Trump administration. Shortly after taking office in 2017, Trump released an executive order barring citizens of seven majority Muslim countries from entering the United States. A flood of litigation ensued as lawyers rushed to airports around the country to represent panicked travelers. Courts blocked the order, and though Trump whined, the administration complied, at least that time around. After the Supreme Court finally issued a ruling upholding the constitutionality of the proclamation, more than a year later, the version of the ban that ultimately went into place was significantly watered down and incorporated a number of exceptions. The final ban was to be clear, stupid, pointless, and cruel, and the court's decision was studiously obtuse as to the hateful intentions behind the policy. But the litigation made a difference in allowing people to enter the country who otherwise would have been stranded. Not all of them, and not enough of them, but some. But for those people, that difference mattered. This is not a stirring tale of the majesty of law above all. It is, however, a story about the usefulness of the legal process as a means of throwing sand in the gears of the machinery of cruelty. And the travel ban was on far firmer legal ground than many of the proposals being floated for Trump's second term. Trump has always been defined by his striking lack of curiosity about the government he sought to lead. To the extent that the 47th president is able to convince the country that he has the authority to carry out his political program as a sort of elected dictator, that will be another victory for Trump's style of empty know-nothingness. In contrast, recognizing why Trump's power isn't unlimited requires a deeper understanding of the mechanisms by which the work of government is actually carried out. Exactly the understanding to which Trump's own apathy is ideologically opposed. The more Americans know about their system of government and the laws that shape it, the better they will be equipped to defend their democracy. That completes the article. The author Quinta Jurcik is a contributing writer at The Atlantic, a fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution, and a senior editor at Lawfare. The title of his article was "Yes, the Law Can Still Constrain Trump." The next article is titled "Political Whiplash in the American Southwest." A national monument gets squeezed and stretched and squeezed again, by Ross Anderson. A slab of uplifted rock, larger than Italy, sits in the center of the American Southwest. It is called the Colorado Plateau, and it is a beautiful place, higher ground in every sense. What little rain falls onto the plateau has helped to inscribe spectacular canyons into its surface. Ice Age mammoth hunters were likely the first human beings to wander among its layered cliff faces and mesas, where the exposed sedimentary rock comes in every color between peach and vermilion. Native Americans liked what they saw. Or so it seems. The plateau has been inhabited ever since, usually by many tribes. They buried their dead in its soil and built houses that blend in with the landscape. In the very heart of the plateau, the ancestral Pueblo people wedged brick dwellings directly into the banded cliffs. Some of the best-preserved ancestral Pueblo ruins are located near two 9,000-foot buttes in southeastern Utah, 75 miles from where its borders form a pair of crosshairs with those of Colorado, New Mexico, and Arizona. The ancestral Pueblo were not the only Native Americans in the area. Other tribes lived nearby, or often passed through, and many of them described the buttes as bear's ears in their own languages. Thousands of archaeological sites are scattered across the area, but they have not always been properly cared for. Uranium miners laid siege to the landscape during the early atomic age, and in the decades since, many dwellings and graves have been looted. In 2015, five federally recognized tribes, the Navajo Nation, the Zuni, the Hopi, the Mountain Ute, and the Ute, joined together to request that President Barack Obama make Bear's Ears a national monument. The Bear's Ears Intertribal Coalition, as they called themselves, wanted to protect as many cultural sites as possible from further desecration. They asked for nearly 2 million acres centered on the buttes. In 2016, Obama created a monument of roughly two-thirds that size. The borders of that monument have been shifting ever since. In late 2017, President Donald Trump erased all but roughly 15% of the protected land in the name of reversing federal overreach and restoring local control. And in the years that followed, mining companies staked more than 80 new hard rock claims within its former borders. The majority were for uranium and vanadium, minerals that are in demand again now that a new nuclear arms race is on and tech companies are looking for fresh ways to power the AI revolution. In 2021, President Joe Biden put the monument's borders back to where they'd started, and the miners' claims were put on hold. Now Trump is reportedly planning to shrink Bear's ears once again, possibly during his first week in office. With every new election, more than 1 million acres have flickered in and out of federal protection. People on both sides of the fight over Bear's ears feel jerked around. In southeastern Utah, the whipsaw of American politics is playing out on the ground, frustrating everyone, and with no end in sight. Von Haydenfelt has worked as a backcountry guide in Bear's Ears since the 1970s. He specializes in archaeological expeditions. Back when he started, the area was besieged by smash-and-grab looters. They used backhoes to dig up thousand-year-old graves in broad daylight, he told me. Some of these graves are known to contain ceramics covered in geometrical patterns, turquoise jewelry, and macaw feather sashes sourced from the tropics. Thieves made off with goods like these without even bothering to refill the holes. Later on, after Bear's Ears had become a popular Utah stopover for tourists passing through to Monument Valley, the looters had to be more discreet. They started coming in the winter months, Haydenfelt told me, and refilling the ancient graves that they pillaged. The majority of the people follow the rules, but it takes so few people who don't to create lifelong impacts on this type of landscape, he said. Haydenfelt lives in Bluff, Utah, a small town to the southeast of Bear's Ears. Its population of 260 includes members of the Navajo Nation, artists, writers, archaeologists, and people who make their living in the gentler outdoor recreation activities. Think backpacking and rock climbing, not ATVs. The town's mayor, Anne Lepinen, told me that on the whole, her constituents strongly oppose any attempt to shrink the monument. More tourists are coming, and now they aren't just passing through on the way to Monument Valley. They're spending a night or two enjoying oat milk lattes and the like before heading off to Bear's Ears. But Bluff is a blue pinprick in bright red southern Utah, where this one town's affection for the monument is not so widely shared. Bailey Hedgeland, the mayor of Monticello, a larger town some 50 miles north, described Bluff to me as a second home community, a place for people from outside the area, code for Californians or retirees. For her and her constituents, the monument and other public lands that surround Monticello are like a boa constrictor, suffocating their town by forcing it into a tourism economy of low-paying seasonal jobs. The extra hikers who have descended on the area often need rescuing. She said they strain local emergency services budgets. I asked Hedgeland which industries she would prefer. Extraction, she said, Her father and grandfather were both uranium miners. San Juan County was built on mining, and at one time we were very wealthy, she said. She understood that the monument was created at the behest of a marginalized community, but pointed out that the residents of Monticello, where the median household income is less than $64,000, are marginalized in their own right. I ask what percentage of them support the National Monument. You could probably find 10, she said. 10%, I ask? No, 10 people, she replied. The election-to-election uncertainty is itself a burden, Hedgeland said. It makes it hard to plan for the future. Even if Trump shrinks the monument again, we can't make the development plans that we need in Monticello, because we know there will be another election coming. Britt Hornsby, a staunchly pro-monument city council member in Bluff, seemed just as disheartened by what he called the federal government's ping-pong approach to Bears Ears. We've had some folks in town looking to start a guiding business, he said, but they have been unable to get special recreation permits with all the back and forth. The only conventional uranium processing mill still active in the United States sits just outside the borders of another nearby town, Blanding. Phil Lyman, who until recently represented Blanding and much of the surrounding area in Utah's House of Representatives, has lived there all of his life. Lyman personifies resistance to the monument. He told me that the archaeological sites were never looted en masse, as Haydenfelt had said. This account of the landscape was simply a lie. In 2009, federal agents raided homes in Blanding and elsewhere, recovering some 40,000 potentially stolen artifacts. While Lyman was serving as the local county commissioner in 2014, 2 years before Bears Ears was created, he led an illegal ATV ride into a canyon that the Bureau of Land Management had closed in order to protect ancestral Pueblo cliff dwellings. Some associates of the anti-government militant Ammon Bundy rode along with him. A few were armed. To avoid violence, assembled federal agents did not make immediate arrests, but Lyman was later convicted and served 10 days in jail. The stunt earned him a pardon from Trump and a more prominent political profile in Utah. When Biden re-expanded the monument in 2021, Lyman was furious. While he offered general support for the state of Utah's legal efforts to reverse Biden's order, he also said that his paramount concern was not these lesser legal arguments, but the federal occupation of Utah itself. Like many people in rural Utah, Lyman sees the monument as yet another government land grab in a state where more than 60% of the land is public. The feds had colluded with environmentalists to designate the monument to shut down industries in a manner befitting of communists, he told me. Davina Smith, who sits on the board of the Bears Ears Intertribal Coalition as representative for the Navajo Nation, grew up just a mile outside of Bears Ears. She now lives in Blanding, not far from Lyman. Her father, like Mayor Hedgeland's, was a uranium miner. But Native Americans haven't always been treated like they belong here, she told me. People in Utah say they want local control, but when we tried to deal with the state, we were not viewed as locals. Indeed, for more than 30 years, San Juan County's government was specifically designed to keep input from the Navajo to a minimum. Only in 2017 did a federal court strike down a racial gerrymandering scheme that had kept Navajo voting power confined to one district. Smith, too, has been tormented by what she called the never-ending cycle of uncertainty over the monument. The tribes have just spent 3 years negotiating a new land management plan with the Biden administration, and it may be all for naught. Each new administration comes in with different plans and shifting priorities, and nothing ever feels like it's moving toward a permanent solution, Smith said. The judicial branch of the federal government will have some decisions of its own to make about the monument and may inject still more reversals. In 2017, the Bears Ears Intertribal Coalition and other groups sued the government over Trump's original downsizing order, arguing that the president's power to create national monuments under the Antiquities Act is a ratchet, a power to create nor shrink or destroy. No federal judge had ruled on that legal question by the time of Biden's re-expansion, and the lawsuit was stayed. If Trump now shrinks the monument again, the lawsuit will likely be reactivated and new ones likely filed. A subsequent ruling in Trump's favor would have far-reaching implications if it were upheld by the Supreme Court. It would defang the Antiquities Act, a statute that was written to protect Native American heritage, empowering any president to shrink any of America's national monuments on a whim. The Biden administration launched an historic run of monument creation. Project 2025, a policy blueprint co-written by Trump's former head of BLM, calls for a shrinking spree. The borders of each one could begin to pulsate with every subsequent presidential handover. An act of Congress might be the only way to permanently resolve the Bears Ears issue. Even with Republican lawmakers in control, such an outcome may be preferable to the endless flip-flops of executive power. Hillary Hoffman, a co-director of the Bears Ears Intertribal Coalition, told me. The tribes have built bipartisan relationships with members of Congress. They may not get as much land for the monument as they did under Obama or Biden, she said. But perhaps a grand bargain could be struck. A similar allotment of protected land could be exchanged for the stability that would allow local communities, including monument supporters and opponents alike, to plan for their future. In the meantime, people in southeastern Utah are waiting to see what Trump actually does. When I ask Smith how the tribes are preparing for the new administration, she was coy. She didn't want to telegraph the coalition's next moves. "We are definitely planning," she told me. "This isn't our first time." Everyone in the fight over Bears Ears has to find some way to cope with the uncertainty. For Smith, it's taking the long view. She invoked the deeper history of the Colorado Plateau. She called back to the Long Walk of the Navajo, a series of 53 forced marches that the U.S. Army used to remove thousands of tribe members from their land in New Mexico and Arizona in the 1860s. When the cavalry came to round up my people, some of them sought refuge in Bears Ears, she said. To this day, I can go there and remember what my ancestors did. I can remember that we come from a great line of resilience. And that's the end of the article. The title was Political Whiplash in the American Southwest. The author of the article was Ross Anderson. Ross Anderson is a staff writer at The Atlantic. He was previously the magazine's deputy editor. As a writer for the magazine, he has reported in Russia, China, India, Pakistan, and Greenland. He is also the author of The Long Search, forthcoming from Random House. And with that, I'm afraid we have run out of time today for the broadcast. This has been the Atlantic Magazine program, brought to you by Sunsounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. It's been my privilege to be your Sunsounds volunteer reader. I've been reading from the online edition of the Atlantic Magazine. All of the articles I've read today were published in January of 2025. I hope you enjoyed the program, and I hope you found it informative. Keep listening to Sunsounds of Arizona, with its premium programming offered on a 24/7 basis. And if you missed an article you'd like to hear, go to the sunsounds.org website, click on the broadcast and broadcast info and audio, then on the next page, click on Demand Podcasts. The next page will bring you a list of articles available to you. Hopefully, you'll find the one you're looking for. Thank you so much for spending your time with me today.